Chapter 8. All hands unmoor ship, said Jack. The bosun's calls wailed and twittered. The boadiceers ran to their stations. The fife began its thin, piercing tune. Stamp and go, cried the bosun's mates. And in the midst of the familiar din of proceeding to sea, Stephen turned from the rail where he'd been staring under his shading hand at the ship lying within the frigate. "I could almost swear I'd seen that vessel before," he said. "Oh, not above 100 times, said Jack. "She's the Windham. The Windham Indiaman again. This time she was outward bound, and they took her in the Mozambique Channel. Sirius very neatly retook her when she shied away from Port Southeast. Didn't Pym tell you?"
"Faith, we had little conversation, Captain Pym and I."
"No, I suppose not. But, however, Pullings snapped her up in his little schooner just as she was running under the guns of Rivière Noire. A good seaman-like officer, Tom Pullings."
"Up and down, sir," called the bosun.
"Thick and dry," came Jack's answer, as automatic as a response in church. And he continued, "And he brought her in cracking on regardless. That was the first I knew of the affair. Let fall there," he cried, directing his voice upwards. The topsails flashed out. The frigate's head swung to the northeast and steadied. She heeled, steeper and steeper, as the courses, t'gallants and staysails were sheeted home in smooth succession, and the way came on her, the water slipping fast and faster still along her side. She shaved the cruel reef of Saint Denis, altered course 2 points to eastward, and setting a flying jib, she stretched for the Ile de la Passe, making her 10 knots watch after watch, her wake a straight green line of phosphorescence in the dark. Every minute counted. Stephen's voyage had taken so little time that there was a possibility the fort had not yet surrendered, and that the Iphigenia still lay under its protection within the reef. Every minute counted. And although sailcloth and spars were so precious they drove her through the sea as though they had a Spanish galleon in chase, with an even greater zeal indeed, so great that they raised the island before the light of day. When he had 2 peaks of the Bamboo Mountain in a line and the Pointe du Diable bearing north 17 west, Jack reduced sail, carried a nightglass up to the foretop, and took the ship in, ghosting along under topsails on the edge of the land breeze. His eyes were used to the night, helped as it was by the stars and the sickle moon. He'd made out a good deal of what lay inshore and out to sea, and when the first dawn came up before the sun, he wasn't surprised to see the Marche and Venus, but not the Astrée, lying 2 miles off the reef to leeward, the Iphigenia just inside it, the Boulogne, Minerve, Nereide, and Ceylon Indiaman far over by Port Southeast, and the charred wrecks of the Sirius and Magicienne in the lagoon. But what did give him a shock was the sight of a 5th ship down there, just astern of the shattered Nereide. Leaning his telescope on the rim and focusing with care, he discovered what she was. The Ranger from Bombay. She was only a transport, but she would have been a treasure ship to the remnant of his squadron, for she carried spare yards and topmasts, besides 300 tons of invaluable stores, and he'd been looking for her arrival at St. Paul's these many days. The Otter, quite unfit for sea, was heaved down in expectation of what she should bring. The Staunch lacked almost everything, and if the Boadicea carried away a spar, she'd have to whistle for it. And here was the Ranger fitting out the enemy. The Boulogne, which must have suffered terribly in the long action, already had her t'gallant yards across. His face took on a harder look. No colours were flying yet from either the fort or the Iphigenia. Had they surrendered? If not, conceivably his boats might tow the Iphigenia through the channel, covered by the Boadicea and the fort, and with even a battered consort he could set about the Venus in the Marche. for although he was short of stores, he was rich in men and ammunition, and this was no time for timid defensive measures. He came down on deck, gave orders for the ensign, the private signal, and a hoist stating his intention. The Boadicea stood in as the sun came up, signals flying, one eye on the French frigates, the other on the fort and the Iphigenia. Farther and farther in. And still no colours, though the sun was now a hand's breadth over the horizon. Another few minutes and the Boadicea would be within random shot. "A gun to windward, Mr. Seymour," said Jack, "and shiver the foretopsail." In reply, the British colours ran up the not-so-distant flagstaff. Yet still the Boadicea hung off. Then, after a pause in which hoists jerked up and down without the flags breaking out, but with a crafty pretense of the halyards jamming, the private's signal. "Hands about ship," said Jack, for the island's private signal was 10 days out of date. Not one of the Boadiceas was unprepared for this, and she came about onto the larboard tack as briskly as a smuggling schooner, staying in her own length. The fort's seaward guns sent plumes of white water leaping from the swell 200 yards short of her. A derisive cheer floated after them, and a little later a line of boats carrying prisoners put off the island for the Manche. The Manche took them aboard and stood after the Venus, which was already beating up under easy sail as though to get to the windward of the Boadicea. As soon as the Manche was up, both French frigates set their topgallants. They could be seen clearing for action, and they came on as though they meant it. Jack gazed at them with the utmost intensity, his eyes hard to his glass, examining their captain's handling of their ships, gauging their sailing qualities, watching for ruses designed to mask their speed. And all the while he kept the Boadicea a little ahead, just out of range. By the time the watch had changed, he knew he had the legs of them. He also knew that the Venus could outsail the Manche, and that if he could induce them to separate. But while his mind was running on to the possible consequences of the separation, to a night engagement, to a boat landing on the reef behind the fort, the French gave over the chase. The Boadicea wore and pursued them, setting her royals to bring them within the extreme range of her brass bow-chaser, perched on the forecastle and firing at the Venus, which wore Amelin's broad pendant. The Venus and the Manche replied with guns run out of their gunroom ports, so low as to be ineffectual at this distance. And so the three ships ran, neither side doing the other any damage, until a lucky shot from the Boadicea, skipping three times over on the smooth swell, came aboard the Venus. The midshipman high on the foremast jack reported a commotion on the Venus quarterdeck. Immediately afterwards the French ships went about, and once more the Boadicea ran south and west. All day she ran, trying every kind of ruse and lame duck trick to lure the faster sailing Venus ahead of the Manche, but nothing would serve. Amelin had no romantic notions of single combat, and he was determined to fight at an advantage. The two Frenchmen kept within half a mile of one another, doggedly chasing the Boadicea over the whole stretch of sea between Mauritius and La Réunion. "At least we're tolerably well acquainted with our enemies," said Jack to Seymour and the quarterdeck in general, when the lights of Saint-Denis bore southwest 2 miles and all hope was gone. "Yes, sir," said Seymour. "We could have given them topgallants at any time. Dirty bottoms, no sort of doubt." "Manche was precious slow shifting her sheets over the stays," said Trollope. "I remarked it twice." "Surely, sir, they're not what you'd call enterprising," said Johnson.
"Slow bellies," said an unidentified voice in the darkness.
In the cabin over a late supper, Jack said to Stephen, "Here's Fellow's list of our requirements. May I beg you to go to Farquhar, tell him how things lie,
and ask him to rouse out all that can possibly be found and have them down by the waterside at St. Paul's in the morning. Make no excuses. I have 1,000 things to do. He'll understand. Before Stephen could answer, Spotted Dick walked in and said, "You sent for me, sir?"
"Yes, Mr. Richardson. You will take the Pearl of Iso with 4 good hands and run up to poor Louis, find the staunch and bring her down. Mr. Peter has her orders ready for you to take."
"So much responsibility for that pimply lad," observed Stephen through his Welsh rabbit.
"Aye," said Jack, who had brought a prize hermaphrodite into Plymouth from far off Finisterre before his voice had broken. "We must depend on our small fry now, men and ships. If we'd had the Otter or even the Staunch with us today, we could have made a dash at that unhandy Manche, you know."
"Could we indeed?"
"Lord, yes," said Jack. "Then I trust we shall tomorrow. I sent Seymour galloping over to St. Paul's to bid Tomkinson leave the Otter where she lies, shift all his people into the Wyndham, and join me in the roadstead. With this wind getting up, Amelin will stand off and on tonight, I'm very sure." Amelin was more off than on in the light of dawn when the Boadicea ran down to St. Paul's, and the Venus and the Manche were a mere flash of topsails against the western sky. But they were there, and once he'd settled that fact beyond any hint of a doubt, Jack Aubrey turned his glass to the distant shipping in the road. "What in hell's name's the Wyndham thinking of?" he cried. "She hasn't even crossed her yards, Mr. Collins. Wyndham, proceed to sea immediately, with a gun. And give her another gun every minute until she weighs. God, what the—" He clapped his mouth shut, and clenching his hands behind his back, he paced up and down.
"His face is darker than I've ever seen it," observed Stephen, looking at him from the taffrail. "Up until now he's borne these reverses with a singular magnanimity, greater by far than I'd looked for. Not a word about Clonfert's disastrous folly. Nothing but sympathy for his wounds and a hope that the French hospital may set him up. No reflection upon Pym's dogged stupidity. Yet there is no greatness of mind without its limits. Is this breaking point?"
"Shot the next gun," said Jack, stopping short in his stride with a furious glare at the far-off Amelin.
"Sir," said Trollope timidly, "a transport's rounding the point. The Emma, I believe, sir."
"Yes, sir, the Emma."
The Emma she was.
And quite apart from her signal, it was evident that she wished to speak the Boadicea as she hovered there, backing and filling in a black fury of impatience. For the slab-sided transport had already spread a great press of sail. "Captain, come aboard, Pendant, Mr. Collins," said Jack. The Emma's sternboat splashed down, pulled across, hooked on, and Pullings came up the side.
"Mr. Pullings," said Jack, "what is this caper?"
"I beg pardon, sir," said Pullings, pale with emotion.
"I have Wyndham's guns aboard, sir. Captain Tomkinson declined the command."
"Come below and explain yourself," said Jack. "Mr. Seymour, carry on. Course north and west."
In the cabin it appeared, from Pulling's nervous, involved, embarrassed statement, that Tomkinson, having looked into the Indiaman's condition, had refused to take her to sea until she should be made seaworthy, and had returned to the immobilized Otter. Pullings, a witness of this, had come to an agreement with the Emma's captain, sick ashore, had moved his men and a score of volunteers into her, she being in a better state than the Indiaman, and by inhuman labour all through the night had shifted the Wyndham's guns and his own carronades across, helped by Colonel Keating, who had also given him gunners and small-arms men.
"This Tomkinson," cried Stephen, who could speak openly before Pullings, "must he not be hanged or flogged, "'Or at least dismiss the service, the infamous whore.'
"'No,' said Jack. "'He's a poor creature, God help him, but he's within his rights. "'A captain can refuse a command on those grounds.' "'Tom,' he said, shaking Pulling's hand, "'you're a right sea officer. "'I'm obliged to you. "'If you can get 8 knots out of your Emma, "'we shall have a touch of those Frenchmen out there before long.'
The two ships bore away in company, steering a course that would give them the weather gauge in a couple of hours, well north of the island, where the wind came more easterly. But in far less time than that it became apparent to all hands that the Emma couldn't keep up. 6, or at the most 7 knots, was her utmost limit, even with the wind abaft the beam, stunsails aloft and alow, and even kites, strange sails without a name, all set and drawing. And once they'd hauled their wind 3 points, even 6 was beyond her power. Driven though she was with all the resources of seamanship and an able, willing crew. The Boadicea had to take in her topgallants to keep the Emma in sight at all. While, on the other hand, Amelin, the necessary complement of a quarrel, kept steadily ahead, with never a sign of reducing sail, still less of heaving to wait for them. Yet, for all that, Amelin had now run so far to the westward that he would have to go up to Port Louis rather than Port Southeast, which was something gained, since it would allow Jack to look into the Ile de la Paz again, and the Emma was there to perform a most important task that should have fallen to the Otter. "'Back the foretopsail, Mr. Johnson, if you please,' said Jack, just before the hands were piped to dinner. And when the Emma had come labouring up, he hailed Pullings, directing him to make for Rodriguez, acquaint the military with the situation, and then to cruise between that island and 57 degrees east to warn any king's or company's ships he saw, at the same time taking all appropriate measures.' "'And Mr. Pullings,' he added in his strong voice, "'I shall not object to your taking one of their frigates, or even two. "'That'll still leave plenty for me.' The joke was limp enough in all conscience. But the tone in which it was said, or rather roared, caused Pullings' distressed, tired face to spread in an answering grin. The Boadicea looked at the Ile de la Paz, which greeted her with a roar of heavy guns. She looked beyond it, over the billowing smoke, into Port Southeast, and there she saw the Boulogne, new rigged and ready for sea. The Minerve now had jury topmasts, and the Nereide something in the way of a main and a mizzen, while caulkers and carpenters were busy about them both. The Iphigenia had already sailed. There was nothing to be done, and the Boadicea turned about for La Réunion. "'Mr. Seymour,' said Jack in that curiously detached, impersonal tone that had come on him since the news of the defeat, "'when did we last exercise the guns?'
"'Several days ago, sir, much longer than usual,' said Seymour, searching wildly in his mind for the exact date, for this new and somewhat inhuman commodore, though neither fault-finding nor severe, put the fear of God into the quarter-deck. It was last Saturday, I believe. "'Then we will advance quarters by 30 minutes and rattle them in and out. We can afford 3 rounds a gun. And I believe we may fire upon targets.'
If Amelin was the man Jack thought him to be, he would surely have Astray and one or two of his corvettes cruising between Mauritius and Réunion by now, and the sound of gunfire might bring them down. So late that afternoon the sky echoed to Boadicea's thunder. The gun crews, stripped to the waist and gleaming with sweat, plied the massive cannon with even more than their usual diligence, for they too had long since caught their commander's mood. He watched them with a grave satisfaction. A remarkably healthy crew, well fed on fresh meat and garden stuff, in fine fettle and high training. Good men. A rapid, accurate fire, surpassing anything that Boadicea had yet achieved by a clear 8 seconds. Although the Boadicea was not and never could be an outstanding sailor, he needn't fear any single French ship afloat in these waters. Nor any two, if only he had the support of a well-handled sloop, and if only he could bring them to that perilous thing, an engagement in the darkness, when high discipline and true aim counted for so much. Yet when the guns were housed and cool again, the sea remained as empty as it had been before. A vast disk of unbroken blue, now fast darkening to deep sapphire. There was to be no action that night. Nor the next day either, in the 20 miles of sea before the frigate dropped anchor at St. Paul's again. No action at sea, but enormous activity on shore. Jack flung himself into the task of getting the Otter and the Wyndham into fighting trim. He took little notice of Captain Tomkinson, now perhaps the unhappiest man on La Réunion, but directed the work himself. With the governor's total intelligence support, he had a sovereign hand in the yards of St. Paul's and Saint-Denis, and there, labouring through the night by flares, every artificer in the island did all that could conceivably be done to turn a 16-gun sloop and a decayed, cruelly battered Indiaman with no guns but what the soldiers could afford her into honorary frigates, or at least into something that might have some remote chance of standing the enemy's fire, of holding him long enough for the Boadicea to run alongside and board. On the Sunday morning, with the Otter in her final stage of refitting, but with the Wyndham still heaved down, he was taking a very late breakfast after 4 hours of the deepest sleep he'd known, taking it in the company of Stephen Maturin, whom he saw but rarely these days. He'd resolutely dismissed the problems of the dockyard from his mind for 20 minutes, when Stephen involuntarily brought them back by asking the significance of the devil among those that followed the sea, as in the devil to pay. A phrase he'd often heard, particularly of late. Was it a form of propitiation, a Manichaean remnant, so understandable, though erroneous, upon the unbridled elements? Why, the devil, do you see, said Jack, is the seam between the deck planking and the timbers. And we call it the devil because it is the devil for the caulkers to come at. In full, we say the devil to pay and no pitch hot. And what we mean is there's something hellfire difficult to be done, must be done, and nothing to do it with. It's a figure. A very elegant figure, too. Was you a weak, superficial cove and feeling low, you might say it described our situation at the moment, said Jack, but you would be wrong. With Staunch and Otter and Wyndham in a day or two... He cocked his ear and called out, Killick, who's that coming aboard? Only an army officer, sir. The clash of marines presenting arms on the quarterdeck, a midshipman to ask whether the Commodore would receive Colonel Fraser, and then the Colonel himself, his face as scarlet as his coat from galloping under the torrid sun. "Good morning, Colonel," said Jack. "Sit down and take a cup."
"Good morning, sir. Doctor, how do you do?"
"Colonel Fraser should instantly drink something cool and throw off his stock," said Stephen. "Your servant, sir."
"Happy to do so in 1 minute. But first I must deliver my dispatch. Verbal, sir. No time to call for pen and ink. Colonel Keating's compliments to Commodore Aubrey, and HMS Africaine is in Saint-Denis. Captain Corbett."
"Corbett? Robert Corbett?"
"I believe so, sir. A little man looks rather black and cross when put out, the same that was here before. Splendid disciplinarian. Captain Corbett, sir, proceeding to Madras, learnt of the state of affairs here from one of your ships when he was putting into water at Rodriguez, so he turned off to La Reunion. He had some kind of a small engagement with a schooner on the coast of Mauritius on the way, and he's now landing his wounded. Colonel Keating has given him 25 men and an officer to take their place because, sir, two French frigates and a brig are coming in after him. And Captain Corbett charges me to say with his duty that he's taken the liberty of hoisting your broad pendant to amuse him, that he's clearing for action, and will put to sea the moment all his wounded are ashore.
Colonel, said Jack, I'm infinitely obliged to you. Killick, light along a jug of something cool for Colonel Fraser. Sandwiches, mangoes. These words he called backwards as he ran onto the quarterdeck. Mr. Trollope, all hands from the yard immediately and prepare to slip the moment they're aboard. Mr. Collins to Otter and Staunch, proceed to sea immediately and enemy cruising east, northeast. Pass the word for the gunner. The gunner came running, for the news was spreading fast. Mr. Webber, said Jack, how much have you filled?
30 rounds a gun, sir, said the gunner, and 23 for the carronades. We've been at it all this forenoon.
And then, encouraged by old acquaintance and by the glowing change in the Commodore, may I hope to fill some more, sir, for the right true end?
Yes, Mr. Webber, said Jack, and none of your white-letter stuff. Let it all be our very best red large grain.
Rounding the Pointe des Galets at noon, the Boadicea, followed by the Otter and the Staunch, made out the French ships in the offing. Two frigates. The French brig was already topsails down to the northwards, no doubt hurrying off to tell Amelin what was afoot. There was a general hum of satisfaction, tempered by the fact that the Frenchmen were no longer standing in, but had gone about on the starboard tack, and by the sight of long white lines far out, which meant that the wind, south or southeast to the leeward of La Réunion, was blowing from the east to the north of it, so that the enemy would have the weather gauge. They also saw the Africaine, and the actual sight of her raised Jack's heart still higher. She was a 36-gun, 18-pounder frigate, French-built, of course, and one of the finest sailors in the Royal Navy, particularly on a wind. She must have been the plum with which Corbett was rewarded when he brought home the St. Paul's dispatches. He'll certainly handle her well, reflected Jack. A capital seaman. Let's hope he's taught his men how to point their guns this time and that he's made himself more amiable aboard her. A plum sometimes had that effect upon a disappointed man, and Corbett had often been disappointed. When he caught sight of her, the Africaine was also on the starboard tack, under a press of sail, about 8 miles south of the enemy. The two ships exchanged numbers, no more. Jack had no intention of worrying the Africaine with signals. Corbett was a fighting captain. He knew very well what to do. There was no doubt that he would do it, and in the meantime he must be left free to concentrate on making up at least 7 of those 8 miles. The same applied with even greater force to the Boadicea. Although she could hit harder than the Africaine, she couldn't rival her in speed. Happily, one of the Frenchmen was their old Iphigenia. Now the Iphigenie once more, and she was no flyer. The other was probably the Astrée, whose qualities he didn't know. He would soon find them out, however, he said, smiling as he took his glass into the foretop, and the 6 ships settled down to the long chase. An hour later he knew that she had an able captain, that she was faster than the Iphigenia, but not faster than the Boadicea, while the Africaine could give her topgallant sails at least. If the wind held true, the Africaine should be up with them before sunset, and the Boadicea not long after dark. If the wind held true, that was his chief concern.
for were it to back more easterly, or even a little north of east, as it sometimes did by night, then the Boadicea would be dead to leeward of the Frenchmen, and they might be able to run up to Port Louis before that leeway could be made up. For the Boadicea was not her best on a bowline, and although he wouldn't have it generally known, she couldn't come up so close to the wind as some other ships, not by half a point, in spite of all his care. Yet, taking thought, would neither keep the wind south of east nor improve the Boadicea's sailing. He came down, glanced at the now distant Staunch and Otter. He told Seymour that he was to be called in case the position changed, and went fast asleep in a hammock slung in the desolate clean sweep fore and aft that had once been his array of cabins, knowing that his officers would sail the ship admirably well, and that he must keep his wits as sharp as they could be for what might well be a difficult night engagement calling for instant decision. When he came on deck again, the Otter and the Staunch were barely in sight from the masthead. The Africaine was something better than 2 leagues ahead, and she was gaining visibly on the Frenchman. At his second hail, the lookout replied, after a studying pause, that Staunch and Otter had vanished now. And while the lookout was answering, an unpleasant rattle accompanied his voice. The wind had come too far forward for the stunsails to set, and they were shivering, in spite of fiddle-taut bowlines. The Boadicea took them in. She lost way at once, and presently the Africaine was a full 8 miles away, pursuing the now invisible French towards the coming night. A dirty night, though warm, with sudden squalls and a mounting cross-sea that kept forcing the Boadicea's head northwards. The best helmsmen in the ship were at the wheel, with Jack behind them, standing by the master at the conn. For some little while after full darkness he saw the rockets and the blue lights that showed the Africaine's position. Then nothing. Hour after hour of low, driving cloud, very heavy showers of rain, the seas breaking over her starboard bow, the wind in the rigging as she stood on and on. But never the sound that the silent listening men were waiting for. Nothing until 7 bells in the middle watch, when the breeze turned gusty before dropping to something near a calm. At 7 bells, and again at the changing of the watch, flashes were seen under the cloud to windward, and remote gunfire followed them. "God send he's not engaged close without me," murmured Jack, altering course for the flash. That fear had occurred to him in these hours of waiting, together with others equally wild. But he'd put it away. Corbett was no Clonfert. And in any case, Corbett knew the Boadicea's rate of sailing perfectly. The gunfire was louder every glass. But at every glass the breeze grew less. And at last the Boadicea had scarcely steerage way. The short twilight before dawn was veiled by a last sheet of tepid rain. It faded slowly in the still air as the sun rose up, and all at once there was the whole stretch of sea brilliantly lit, and upon it, 4 miles away, the Africaine, with one French ship within pistol shot on a bow, another on her quarter. She was firing an occasional gun. The enemy answered with full broadsides. Then she fell silent. 4 miles away. Clear in his telescope, Jack saw her colours waver at the peak and come slowly down, down, right down on deck. And still the French kept firing. For a quarter of an hour they kept firing into her silent hull. Never had he had to master himself with such force. The sight was so horrible that if the breeze hadn't got up while he was watching, it seemed that his heart must break with grief and rage. The Royals took it first. The Boadicea gave a gentle heave against the sea, and the water began to whisper along her side. Jack gave his orders automatically. Said, "Mr. Seymour, the slow match needs renewing," and took the Boadicea down towards the Frenchmen as they lay about their prize, the boats coming and going. "Masthead there," he called. "What do you see of Staunch and Otter?"
"Nothing, sir," came the reply. "Nothing to windward, nothing to leeward."
Jack nodded. The breeze was freshening. He could feel it on his cheek, coming beautifully, though soft, from the southeast, and even south of that, the breeze that would have brought him up. The Boadicea stood on. And as they watched, the African's masts went by the board. First her foremast, then the mizzen, then the main. The Astrea and the Iphigenia didn't appear to have suffered at all. Whatever it cost, he must resist the temptation to run down and engage them. It would be criminal folly. But the temptation to set the Boadicea right between the two, firing both sides, was terribly strong. And with the wind as it lay, he might be able to yield just so far and still regard his duty. A quick, hard strike in a way was allowable. It was even called for. "Mr. Seymour," said he, "I'm going to run down to within musket shot of the windward ship. When I give the order, let the starboard guns fire, starting from forwards. Deliberate fire at her stern, the smoke to clear between each shot. When the last gun has fired, about ship, and then the larboard broadside as we go about to come up as near as she'll lie. Mr. Buchan, lay me for the Iphigenia." The Boadicea was bringing up the wind. The Frenchman had steerage way, but little more, while she was moving at 3 knots. And the Astrea, behind the Africaine, hadn't run clear before Jack said, "Fire!" The guns went off in steady, even succession. Undisturbed by the ragged broadsides from the Iphigenia, the first too wild, the third deadly enough. The Boadicea's was a deliberate fire, aimed with hatred, and hammocks and splinters of rail leapt from the Iphigenia's stern. One fine shot from number 12 struck her between wind and water very near her rudder, and a cheer went up. Then the cry, "Helms alee!" and the Boadicea came up into the wind. She was in stays when the Astrea, clear of the Iphigenia and the Africaine, at last let fly. She hit the Boadicea very hard, shattering the sternboat on its davits and giving her such a blow that for a moment Jack thought she was going to fall off, that he'd risked her just that hair's breadth too far. "Flat in forward there," he cried. Felt the fine balance change, and with infinite relief called, "Mainsail haul!" Round she came and filled, the way still on her, round, round, till her larboard port stared full at the Iphigenia. With one great rippling crash, her broadside went off, and she sailed clear of her smoke. At the same moment, a shot from the Astrea struck the master in the back, cutting him in two at Jack's side. Jack saw his astonished, indignant face jerk forward, knocking the starboard helmsman down. He took the man's place for a moment, bringing the frigate still farther round until her headsail shivered and a quartermaster seized the spokes. Then, stepping over the body, he walked to the taffrail. The Iphigenia's stern had suffered, but her rudder hadn't gone, nor yet her mizzenmast. She dropped her foresail and was now before the wind, moving down towards the Astrea, masking her fire again. He heard the master's body splash into the sea as he considered her. A scratch crew, no doubt, with not much sense and still less appetite for a close engagement with the Boadicea. And as the Boadicea stretched away close-hauled, and the distance widened, He saw the Iphigenia put up a helm and fall foul of the Astrae, just as the Astrae tried to slip through the gap between her and the Africaine to rake the Boadicea at extreme range. He took the frigate some way to windward, and there heaved to. In the brilliant sunlight he could see the French ships perfectly, the people on their decks, even the state of their rigging. Sitting on the slide of the aftermost carronade, he contemplated the scene. For this was a time for contemplation. No sudden decisions were called for at this point, nor would they be required for some considerable time. The Astrae was a formidable ship. She was undamaged. She had disentangled herself from the Iphigenia and had worn clear at last. The sea between her and the Boadicea was clear. Yet she didn't come on. Her shivering foretopsail, her deliberately shivering foretopsail, told him a great deal about her commander, and a score of less obvious details told him more. A competent seaman, no doubt, but he didn't mean to fight. He no more meant to fight than Amelin, at an even greater advantage, had meant to fight. Neither this man nor his commodore chose to risk the throw. The conviction, growing stronger as he watched, filled him with grave joy. On the other hand, said his reason as it compelled his heart to be quiet, the Astrae carried a great broadside weight of metal. Her gunnery was accurate. And although she wasn't faster than the Boadicea, she could haul closer to the wind. Then again, attack and defence were two different things. In a close action, the Astrae would do tolerably well. And although the Iphigenia was handled by a nincompoop, tackling the two of them together by daylight would be unjustifiable in the present balance. Yet he must necessarily retake the Africaine. "On deck there," hailed the lookout. "Two sail right to windward, sir. I think it's Staunch and Otter." Some minutes later, "Yes, sir. Staunch and Otter." With this wind, it would take them 2 or 3 hours to reach him. Very well. He stood up, smiling, and looked across to the lee side, where his first lieutenant, the carpenter, and the boatswain were waiting to report. 3 wounded, sir," said Seymour, "and, of course, poor Mr. Buchan." The carpenter had only 4 shot holes and 8 inches of water in the well. Fellows gave an account of a fair amount of damage to the sails and rigging forward. "I reckon an arrow'll see it to rights, sir," he added. "As smartly as ever you can, Mr. Fellows," said Jack. "Mr. Seymour, let the hands go to breakfast, and the watch below must have some rest." He went down into the orlop, where he found Stephen reading in a small book, holding it up to the lantern.
"Are you hurt?"
asked Stephen. "No, not at all, I thank you. I'm come down to look at the wounded. How are they coming along?"
"Collie, the depressed cranial fracture, I will not answer for. He's comatose, as you see. We must operate as soon as we have peace and quiet and light. The sooner the better. The 2 splinter wounds will do very well. Your breeches are covered with blood."
"It's the master's. He lost the number of his mess right by me, poor fellow." Jack went over to the patients, asked them how they felt, told them that things looked very well on deck, that Staunch and Otter were coming up hand over fist, and that presently the Frenchmen might be served out for what they did to the Africaine. Returning to Stephen, he said, "Killick has a little spirit stove on the go, if you could fancy breakfast." And standing by the stern window, while the coffee flowed into them by the pint, he explained the situation, pointing out just how the French lay now and how they'd lain at different stages. "I know you'll think it illogical," he said, his hand firmly gripping the wooden frame, "and maybe even superstitious, but I have a feeling that the tide has turned. I don't mean to tempt fate, God forbid, but I believe that when the Staunch and the Otter join, we shall retake the Africaine. We might even snap up the Iphigenia. She's shy. I think we may have hit her hard. Look at the people over her side. And the captain of the Astray don't trust her. But I'll not go so far as that. The Africaine will be enough. On deck once more, and a surprisingly respectable deck with the knotting and splicing almost finished, the swabbers of the afterguard washing the last pale smears from by the wheel, the davits righted, a new foretopsail bent. Over the water, the French boats were still removing prisoners from the Africaine. The Iphigenia's pumps were going hard. And from the look of the feverish activity among the parties inboard and outboard of her, she would be in no way to get under sail for some time. The Astrée had moved into a better position to cover her, and the Africaine. Her captain might be no fire-eater, but clearly he meant to cling to his prize if he possibly could. But now from the deck the Staunch and Otter could be seen hull up, and the breeze was blowing fresher. An early dinner, cold, and the grog cut by half. Yet there was no grumbling. The Commodore's look of contained pleasure, his certainty, the indefinable change that had come over him, had spread a feeling of total confidence throughout the ship. The hands ate their good biscuit and their execrable cheese, wetted with more watered lime juice than rum, and they looked at him. They looked at the Frenchmen in their uneasy heap to leeward. They looked at the two ships coming closer every minute, and they talked in low, cheerful voices. There was a good deal of quiet laughter in the waist and on the forecastle. With a piece of chalk, the Commodore drew his plan of attack on the deck. The captains of the sloop and the brig watched attentively. The three were to run down in line abreast, the Boadicea in the middle, and they were to endeavour to separate the two French frigates. There were many possibilities, depending on the movements of the Astrée, and Jack explained them clearly. "But at all events, gentlemen," he said, "in case of the unforeseen, you'll not go far wrong by closing with the Iphigenia ahead and astern, and leaving the Astrée to me." With the wind 3 points abaft the beam, and under topsails alone for freedom of manoeuvre, they bore down. The brig, looking pitifully small on the Boadicea's starboard beam, and the sloop, a mere wisp to port. Jack had given them plenty of time to feed and rest their hands. He knew that they were thoroughly prepared and well manned, and that their commanders understood his intentions beyond any sort of doubt. He'd foreseen a great many possibilities, and he stood on with a confidence that he'd rarely felt so strongly before, a steady rising of his heart. But he hadn't foreseen what, in fact, took place. They were still a mile and a half away when the Astrée passed the Iphigenia at towline and both frigates made sail. Abandoning the Africaine, they gathered away, packed on more sail and still more, hauled their wind and stretched to the eastwards as fast as they could go, the fine-sailing Astrée keeping the Iphigenia's head right up to the wind, closer than ever the Boadicea could lie. By coming to instantly, it was conceivable that since she was somewhat to windward, the Boadicea might bring them to action at the end of a very long converging chase, in spite of the Astrée's superiority on a bowline. But neither the Otter nor the Staunch could possibly keep up. And in the meantime, it was probable that Amelin's reinforcement, brought by the French brig, would be down for the Africaine. No. This, alas, was a time for discretion. And the Boadicea stood quietly on for the sad, dismantled hulk, which lay wallowing on the swell with no more than her ensign staff to show the French colours. The Boadicea came alongside. The Africaine fired two guns to leeward, and the French colours came down, to the sound of immense cheering from the prisoners still aboard her. "Mr. Seymour," said Jack, with a feeling of anticlimax, yet with a deep glowing satisfaction beneath it, "be so good as to take possession." "What the devil is this?" This was the sight of a score of Africaines plunging into the sea, swimming across and swarming up the side of the Boadicea. They were in a state of wild enthusiasm, joy and rage strangely mingled. Nearly all sense of discipline was gone, and they crowded, dripping, onto the quarterdeck, begging the Commodore to renew the action. They would fight his guns for him. They'd be happy to serve under Captain Aubrey. Not like under some brass-bound buggers. They knew him, and they knew he could serve those French farts out for what they'd done. Take on two of them at any time, like kiss your hand. "I know you can do it, sir," cried one with a bloody dressing round his upper arm. "I was shipmates along of you in Sophie when we fucked the big Spaniard. Don't you say no, sir." "I'm glad to see you, Harold," said Jack, "and I wish I could say yes with all my heart. But you're a seaman. Look how they lay. 3 hours stern chase and 5 French frigates to northwards, ready to come down for the Africaine. I understand your feelings, lads, but it's no go. Bear a hand with a towline, and we shall take your barkie into St. Paul's and refit her. Then you shall serve the Frenchman out yourselves." They looked longingly at the Astrée and the Iphigenia, and they sighed. But as seamen they had nothing to say. "How's Captain Corbett?" asked Jack. "Did the French take him aboard?" Silence. Then, "Don't know, sir." He looked at them in surprise. In front of him was a row of closed faces. The rare, immediate man-to-man contact was entirely gone. He'd run straight into the brick wall of lower-deck dumbness. The covering-up solidarity he knew so well, often stupid, generally transparent, but always unbreakable. "Don't know, sir," was the only answer he would ever get.